Support for the World's Podcast comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people build their CQ, or Curious Quotient, through the game of lifelong learning. Curious, where people can learn something new every day at Curious.com/the world.
Israelis feel the burn and stump for Trump today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Israelis can't vote in the U.S. elections, but they're not afraid to choose sides. Some would go for Sanders.
When I saw Bernie, I saw a political address that I can relate to. And this is something that it's really hard for me to find in Israel.
Others would go for Trump.
We just love to say as it is, you know? And I think Trump is very much like that. I think that if he was in the Israeli politics, he would probably succeed very much.
Plus, new pathogens leave health officials scrambling.
We can't develop drugs and vaccines fast enough to contain them before a lot of people experience untreatable disease.
Those stories today here on The World. Thank you for being here. A lot going on this Monday, including Israelis' views of what's taking place on the campaign trail here in the U.S. One word: confusion. And if you think I'm talking about the race itself, you would not be wrong, but I'm actually talking about how confused Israelis are by what they're seeing here. I get that. But let's start with Syria. Confusion there? A bit, especially today with Russia announcing it is starting to pull its military out of Syria. That could bode well for the new round of talks on Syria that kicked off today in Geneva. And I just say talks because when I chatted with my BBC colleague Bethany Bell earlier, I hesitated to call them peace talks.
They are called peace talks.
Okay.
They're called that.
All right. That is my colleague at the BBC, Bethany Bell. She's in Geneva. So the fact that there is another round of talks, this is a positive sign. Is that what the parties are saying?
Yes. And I think diplomats are hoping to try and build on this fragile partial truce, which has reduced the level of violence in Syria ever since it came into effect at the end of February. But the expectations here aren't high. We heard from Syria's foreign minister at the weekend. He was saying that there would be no discussion on the future of President Assad. He said that was a red line. And he also said that the opposition couldn't come to Geneva to try and get in negotiations what they failed to win on the battlefield. And then also we've heard from the opposition saying Assad has to go. Assad has no place in a government, a new government in Syria.
So who is at these talks right now and who crucially is not at these talks?
At the talks, there's a delegation from the Syrian government. There is also the main Syrian opposition alliance, the High Negotiations Committee, which is backed by Saudi Arabia. Those who are not there include the Kurds, the main Kurdish group, the PYD. That's because Turkey objects to their presence. And of course, also not at the table are the so-called Islamic State and the al-Nusra Front, the jihadist Islamist groups.
Right. So the sides that are there, what are their key demands right now?
Well, what the UN says it's hoping to try and do here in Geneva is to set up an agenda where they start talking about transitional government, moving from what is now the case to a future. But as you can see, you know, just from what I've been saying about the two sides, that the positions are very, very different, very far apart. Now, the UN Special Envoy for Syria, speaking here in Geneva today, said, really, we're at a moment of truth for the peace talks. He said, the mother of all issues at the table here is political transition. And he said the only alternative, the only plan B, is a return to war, which he says would be even worse than before if they can't keep these talks alive. The special envoy says that if he doesn't see the two sides being willing to negotiate, he will pull in the big foreign backers, the United States, Russia, the UN Security Council, to try and get them to try and put as much pressure on the sides to try and get something to come out of this. But it's going to be tough going.
I gather the Syrian government has submitted a document called Basic Elements for a Political Solution. What is that all about? Is that also transition?
It's their ideas, we understand. I haven't seen the details of it myself yet. I haven't actually received a copy of that document, but it's certainly their suggestions for the way things could go on. It's likely to be very far apart from what the suggestions of the oppositions would be. The big question people are waiting to hear to see whether they actually stay here in Geneva for the next few days, whether they will continue talking on until the 24th, which is what the UN is hoping they will do, and then break for a short period and then meet again and then break for another short period and meet again. You know, it's a long, drawn-out process. They're not sitting down together in the same room. These are indirect negotiations. So it's about, at the moment, just trying to keep them talking, just trying to come up with some sort of framework that they can discuss over the next few weeks so that they know where they're going.
My colleague, the BBC's Bethany Bell, speaking with me from Geneva. Thanks very much for the update, Bethany.
Thank you.
And as they talk, the war in Syria is about to reach an unfortunate milestone, 5 years since the start of the uprising. More than 1 million Syrians have sought refuge in Lebanon since that time. And a lot has changed for the refugees, not just the way Lebanon treats them, but in the way they view their host country and their prospects there. We're going to hear the stories now of three Syrian women in Lebanon whose 20s have been defined by the war. Each one fled to Lebanon at different times during the past 5 years. And as Venetia Rainey reports, their feelings about home, as you would expect, are complicated.
When Aisha Hassan thinks of home, this song by Carlos Azar is what comes to mind. It's been more than 4 years since she fled from Syria with her parents to Lebanon, and not a day goes by when she doesn't think about what she left behind in Homs, her studies, her friends, everything she knew.
At first, when we came here, we considered that we're going to stay here maybe for 2 years. We didn't think that we're going to stay. When I think about it, really, it's 4 years and we are still here. It's not easy.
Her mother is Lebanese, so Aisha had visited Lebanon before. But living in Tripoli as a refugee, it's different. Still, she realizes that as one of the early arrivals, she actually had it relatively good.
When we came here, more organizations were ready to help people. And even the Syrian people were satisfied more.
Over time, Aisha was able to blend in at work and at her university. In fact, other students would make mean jokes about Syrians in front of her, not realizing where she was actually from. This undercurrent of hostility and the nagging feeling she's unwelcome has tainted her experience here. Before the war, she dreamt of being a professor, but now, at 25, she can't imagine what her future will look like.
Of course I cannot, because 2 years later, I think I'm not going to be here. So how can I imagine a future here in Lebanon?
Marwa left Syria about 1 year after Aisha. She's a 24-year-old stay-at-home mom who lives with her two sons and husband in Mount Lebanon. The song that reminds her of home in Damascus is Hilwe Ya Baladi. It translates as, "How beautiful is my country." I ask, isn't there beauty here too? She just shakes her head.
We couldn't see that before. When we first arrived, we weren't very happy. But now, after 3 years, we adjusted a little bit. My husband's salary is just enough to cover the rent, and my kids are in school. If it wasn't for this, I would go back to Syria, war or not.
Marwa says her Lebanese neighbors have slowly warmed to her, but still, the overall situation for Syrians here is constantly getting more difficult. People's savings are running out.
My neighbor is going back to Syria. Even though there's a lot of suffering there, she's in too much debt here. My husband is thinking the same, because he's paid so little at work. He can't take it anymore. I tell him, you can go back, but I'm not going with you. What did our children do to deserve living in the middle of a war?
At the end of 2014, the Lebanese government closed the country's borders to Syrian refugees. These days, only emergency cases and those in transit are allowed in. Hala likes to listen to Shadi Jamil's Your Name, O Aleppo, whenever she feels homesick.
Oh, yeah,
The 31-year-old accountant came from the northern Syrian city with her mother last September. They'd secured an interview for their application to emigrate to Canada. Hala says getting into Lebanon is a nightmare.
It's so difficult. If you want to stay in Lebanon for a long time, you have to get a sponsor, and the sponsor should be Lebanese nationality first, and second, should have a property in Lebanon. So yeah, it's difficult to find a person who sponsors you.
Hala was lucky. She's managed to find a job and an apartment while she waits for her Canada interview. She likes life in Lebanon, but she's still keen to get out.
If I think about my mind, I have to go to Canada, where there is a right for the refugees, and we're never told to go back to Syria.
5 long years of war with no real end in sight. And as life becomes increasingly precarious for those here in Lebanon, they can only hope for a chance at life somewhere else. For The World, Venetia Rainey, Beirut.
Of course, many Syrians aren't staying in Lebanon, or Turkey for that matter. They're still trying to get to Europe, even though European countries are shutting their doors. The Syrians pay smugglers to pack them onto flimsy rubber boats crossing from Turkey to Greece. When this was happening over the summer on the Greek island of Kos, you began to see a surreal image. People in bikinis sunning themselves as refugees in life jackets struggled to get ashore. Two worlds colliding. That's what German photographer Jörg Brueggemann witnessed when he traveled to Kos this summer.
The thing with the tourists is that I guess a lot of them were actually already considering canceling their holiday because Kos was so big on the news. But a refugee crisis is not like a nature catastrophe, a reason to cancel your holiday and get your money back. So a lot of people stayed with their booked holiday and went there, and they obviously knew what was going on.
Some of the tourists Brueggemann met ended up spending their vacation helping refugees, distributing food and clothing. But he also says he spoke with others who just completely ignored what was going on. So Brueggemann published a series of photos from Kos called Tourist versus Refugees.
So it's this really strange situation everyone is in, and everyone is kind of confronted with the life of the other in public space in this even more obscure situation of a holiday island, which is already like kind of out of everyday life, obviously, you know, because it's like trying to be a paradise, trying to pretend to be a paradise. And then people in a almost biblical way coming over with like rubber boats and being happy to land on the beach.
We've all seen those harrowing pictures of refugees landing on the beach, some of them on the shores of Kos and nearby Lesbos. For Brueggemann, those images are important, but he worries that people looking at them are beginning to lose a sense of empathy. He wanted to find another way to tell this story.
Getting the idea of the tourist into that series, for me, was in that sense important because it makes it possible for the viewer to relate to that whole story again. It kind of like drags you in because you could be that tourist, right? You could be these people that like middle class people that go to Greece for 2 weeks to have their holiday. I mean, I could be that. And all of a sudden you feel related to that story and you see, you know, how they react to what they see on that island. And I feel that gets a lot more personal, or I hope at least that it gets a lot more personal through that. And that was probably the one thing that was most important to me.
And there's another piece of this picture. Greece is struggling and desperately needs tourists. So let's say you're a tourist planning a holiday on Kos. Would you decide to cancel because it seems callous to lie on the beach as refugees land on the shore? Or would you go enjoy your vacation with the idea that you're at least in some small way helping Greece's economy? An interesting question, and we'd like to know what you think. Head over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/PRI the world and give us your thoughts. And you can see some of Brueggemann's pictures there as well. Coming up, the legacy of journalist Ben Bagdikian right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Kizale Square in Turkey's capital Ankara was packed with people relaxing at outdoor cafes last night or just waiting for a bus. Then an explosion ripped through the neighborhood.
It was heard far and wide across Ankara. It was huge.
That's journalist and blogger Donatella Lorch in Ankara. No group has claimed responsibility for the blast, but Turkey's government says it has, quote, almost certain evidence that the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, was behind the car bombing. Lorch says the event has rattled the city. She lives about 2 miles uphill from where the bomb exploded.
I was cooking dinner. I heard the explosion and my windows rattled.
So tell us about this area where the explosion happened. What was it like before the blast and now after the blast?
It was an area right near a beautiful park. Parliament's not that far away. It's the hip place of Ankara, but it's also a major bus stop. And these minibuses called dolmushes stop there. One of the buses was very badly hit. Very adjacent to Kizilay is the place where there's cinemas and great restaurants, and it's full of cafes because Turks love cafes and have some of the best cappuccino around. So it was utter chaos. Ambulances came immediately to the scene. You could hear them coming from across the city.
I also understand the government imposed a blackout on Twitter and Facebook. Is that unusual?
That has happened before and in other bombings. Last night, it went out for maybe an hour or two and then was really slow in restarting. Interestingly enough, Facebook Messenger still worked. And many people have other means, which is other have VPNs, and they communicate that way. Just after the explosion, there was footage on television, on Turkish television, of the site and the burned out buses and the chaos at the site and the ambulances arriving. But within 15 to 30 minutes, I didn't look at my watch exactly, it was shut down and regular programming came back on, which has happened before in similar circumstances.
Aside from being a business and social center, is there some important symbolism of Kizilay Square and attacking it?
Ankara always gets the second billing to Istanbul because Istanbul is the ancient, magnificent capital of 16 million people, and Ankara is out in the Anatolian steppe with a lot less traffic than Istanbul, I'd like to point out.
Right.
But this is the heart of the city. When you talk Ankara, you talk about Kizilay, you say, I'll meet you in Kizilay, or I'll meet you in Tunali, which is right near there. This is where you go to bars. This is where you go to funky restaurants. So it is the heart of the intellectual and government population in many ways of Ankara.
This is the third terrorist attack in Ankara since October. Why is this happening?
None of this potentially would be happening if it hadn't been for Syria and the complications that exist because of the Syrian problem. And to give you an example of how complicated these alliances, these political alliances are, the U.S. government, the Turkish government, and the European Union agrees that the Kurdish Workers' Party, the PKK, is a terrorist group. But the U.S. government works with the Kurdish group in Syria that the Turks say is associated with the PKK and is a terrorist group. And both Turkey and the U.S. work with Kurds in Iraq. At the same time, you have the president of Syria that used to be good friends, reputedly good friends with the president of Turkey, and reputedly they went on holiday together and now are sworn enemies. And you have Russia in the bargain as well. And you have this overwhelming sort of cloud of the potential perfect storm of refugees that could be gathering if Aleppo and if Mosul falls and if the situation in Afghanistan gets way worse. And where are they going to come into? They're going to come into Turkey. Where else are they going to go?
It's interesting. Ankara is not a war zone, but I'm going to guess that this blast for a lot of people is going to be thought of as happening in a country that is dealing with war on its soil. I mean, you're not going to see a lot of Je suis Ankara tweets, are you?
Well, Turkey has been incredibly generous to refugees. It has brought in and has given a refuge to 2.5 million Syrians. And there are many more Iraqis and Afghans that come through. But it's also become the waypoint to get to Greece and to Europe. There are all these balls in the air.
Journalist and blogger Donatella Lorch speaking with me from Ankara, Turkey. She's a former correspondent with the New York Times. Donatella, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
We're going to take a moment now to remember a man who had a major impact on journalism here in the U.S. That's Ben Bagdikian. His parents were Armenian, and in the 1920s, a family fled Ottoman Turkey to escape persecution. Ben Bagdikian went on to become a renowned journalist. He helped publish the Pentagon Papers and later served as dean of University of California Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. This weekend, he died at the age of 96. Earlier, I spoke with UC Berkeley journalism professor William Drummond about Ben Bagdikian's legacy.
Ben was a man of extraordinary even temperament. If you mention Turkey, though, something in him kind of snapped. I remember his telling this story about how he was smuggled out of Turkey, where he was born, in the saddlebags of a donkey.
Wow!
As a child. He was born in 1920, which was when the massacre of the Armenians was in full swing. So
I never heard him comment specifically, I mean, on the situation as it exists today, but I knew that that was not one subject where we were going to have any kind of a balanced conversation.
Did his passion also kind of run through the Mideast, starting in Turkey?
Not exactly. I had served some time in Jerusalem. We chatted a little bit about that. For the most part, as a dean, as the man that I knew, what his biggest contribution to the journalism school was that he brought credibility to the whole discussion of ethics. Because, unfortunately, the people that you see who are opining on ethics today have never been reporters. If they were reporters, they weren't very good. And they've never been editors, proper editors that had to handle the biggest story in the world. So most of their advice doesn't really carry a lot of impact. But the students at the time, when Ben was teaching, and he was teaching the ethics class, he brought with him huge amounts of credibility because everybody knew him and respected him, and they knew that he had been there on the line and making decisions under uncertainty, facing all sorts of grave consequences, getting criticism. In that sense, I think he was the best ethics professor that anybody could ever have.
Did he try to steer himself away from commenting about Turkey or recusing himself from any stories about Turkey?
Yeah, I know. He never, in my experience with him, ever wrote about that. That was just something that, you know, I had a feeling that this was something that was just so emotionally ingrained in him that he might have deliberately kept himself away from that, because I don't think that he had, you know, in his own mind, the ability to have a balanced viewpoint on that.
I mean, it sounds like he really was kind of an endangered species in terms of ethics and journalism. What do you think we lose when we lost Ben Begdekian?
Well, ethics in journalism no longer exists. Ethics in journalism died. One of the lessons that Ben always taught our incoming graduate students, and I think he always gave this lecture the very first meeting he had with him, he said that you should always put aside a go-to-hell fund, a couple of weeks of payday in the bank. When that occasion occurs, when somebody comes to you and they ask you to do something that you cannot countenance doing, and then you just say thank you very much and you leave. I don't think people can do that anymore.
William Drummond, a professor at UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism, telling us about the late dean of the school, Ben Begdekian, dead at 96. Bill, thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Coming up, from cholera to Zika, a historical look at pandemics here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, it's man versus computer head-to-head in a best-of-five matchup. The game is Go, an ancient test of strategy. The computer won the first three games. The human took the first consolation game.
This is probably the beginning of the end for humans being the best entities in the world at Go.
Somebody alert the Terminator. That's coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The Zika virus continues its spread across the Americas, and coming up on The World, we're going to take a closer look at what we know and what we don't know about this virus. But first, I wanted to get some historical perspective from Sonia Shah. She's the author of Pandemic, Tracking Contagions from Cholera to Ebola and Beyond.
Cholera, you know, it's actually caused by a bacteria that lives in marine environments naturally. But when people started colonizing wetlands in the 18th and 19th century in the Sundarbans, which is part of South Asia, the British Raj decided to cut down all of these wetlands and turn them into rice fields. And people came into very close contact with this marine bacteria probably for the first time. And it started to adapt to human bodies and become, you know, highly virulent. So cholera emerged out of Asia in 1817. By 1832, it was in Europe, and then it had spread right across the Atlantic into the United States, where we were building canals, you know, and we had steamships. And so we had this kind of perfect watery highway for cholera to penetrate again and again.
So boats back then, today we travel by air. Where have you seen air travel accelerating the same dynamic that we once saw with ships?
I mean, Zika virus is a perfect example. You know, we had Zika virus in the 1940s and probably even before that in the equatorial forests of Africa and Asia. But it wasn't until just recently that it was able to hop a flight, basically from Asia into Rio. Once it got there, it reached these vast susceptible populations, you know, because there's been massive urban expansion across the tropical Americas, and that has allowed the Aedes aegypti mosquito, which is very efficient at spreading Zika virus around, to, you know, start to ferry this virus around. And that's why we've seen this huge explosion of Zika virus now.
You went to the wet markets in Asia. What are they, and how are they a breeding ground for human flu pandemics?
So these are markets where wild animals are to be sold live to consumers. So these were animals that in nature would never encounter each other. And yet in these wet markets, they're crammed really close together in these cages where they're breathing on each other. Their, you know, excreta is getting contaminated with each other's. They're sneezing on each other. So they're able to pass microbes between each other. And this is what we saw happen with SARS. The SARS virus is a virus of bats, most likely. Probably lived in bats for a long time, didn't cause any trouble. Mm. Well, then bats are brought into a wet market. And in the wet market, the virus from the bats was able to get into cats. And cats are very vulnerable to this virus and allowed the virus to change in ways that then allowed it to jump into humans. So this is kind of this odd sequence of events that we are making more and more likely by bringing wild animals together in these strange conglomerations. So we kind of create pathogens by lining up all these unlikely events together.
A lot of this is personal for you, Sonia Shah. Your family had, still has, episodes of MRSA, the secondary, sometimes lethal infection people can pick up in a hospital when they're being treated for something else. I hope I'm stating that accurately. From your own experience and research, what do we need to do to better prevent and address these potential threats, these microbial threats?
Well, the one that we have is the MRSA, which we acquired from the community, actually. So this is something that started in hospitals and prisons and then spilled out, and now people are just getting it from the general environment. My son most likely picked it up from a turf field when he was playing soccer.
Wow.
And, you know, and it's a pretty serious infection, and once you have it, it doesn't seem like you can get rid of it. And then it passed on to his brother and to me and, you know, and so on, despite all of the measures we took to prevent that from happening. But I think one of the problems that we face today is that we, as a society, have for many decades relied on biomedicine to kind of protect us from infection. You know, we've stopped thinking of infectious disease as something that really affects our lives in any serious way because it's, you know, the idea is, oh, well, we'll just take an antibiotic. Oh, we'll just get a vaccine. But what we're seeing with these new pathogens is that we can't develop drugs and vaccines fast enough to contain them before a lot of people experience untreatable disease. So what we really need to do is go back to more basic fundamental preventive measures where we're looking at the conditions that lead to these pathogens emerging and trying to minimize those rather than what we do now, which is wait until infection occurs, wait until it starts erupting, and once the fire is lit, then we try to put it out with drugs and vaccines. It just takes too long to develop new drugs and vaccines, and these pathogens, you know, they spread exponentially.
When you think about pandemics, Sonia, what worries you most right now?
I find the Zika virus somewhat more worrying than I think a lot of people do. I mean, I'm not of childbearing age, but the cryptic nature of this virus that spreads in mosquitoes and causes birth defects, that is very unusual. And the fact that so many people can have it and not know, and I think, you know, it's very hard to avoid the bites of these particular mosquitoes. And if it does cross over into some of the other Aedes mosquitoes that we have in this country that are much more common than Aedes aegypti, we only have Aedes aegypti in, you know, the Gulf Coast area in Florida and Texas, but we have Aedes albopictus, which has caused outbreaks of Zika in the past, that mosquito is all over the place. I live with it here in Baltimore. About 60% of the U.S. population is exposed to that mosquito. So if this virus is able to spread into that mosquito, and mind you, it already has switched hosts, like it already has done that several times, that it's jumped from one species of mosquito to another. If it does that here, then, you know, there'll be a much larger swath of the population that will be vulnerable to Zika. You know, at this point, we're not going to have a Zika vaccine for 3 to 10 years. By then, you know, everyone who is vulnerable to it or susceptible to it or living in places where these mosquitoes are, it's probably going to be exposed.
Sonia Shah is a science writer. Her new book is called Pandemic, Tracking Contagions from Cholera to Ebola and Beyond. Sonia, great to speak with you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
For an update on Zika, we turn now to Christian Lindmeier, a spokesperson for the World Health Organization. He joins me from Geneva. So we just heard from Sonia Shah, the author of Pandemic, telling me that she's more worried about Zika than any other outbreak, simply because it is so cryptic. Is that warranted?
Zika is definitely very scary right now, and the main reason for this, there are many unknowns about it. We don't yet know what it's responsible for. We don't yet know if all the microcephaly cases, the deformations in babies' heads, are caused by it, whether other neurological syndromes like the Guillain-Barré syndrome are caused by it. And that unknown is what scares people a lot. But in other terms, it doesn't kill as many people as even malaria or as dengue. So I think in numbers of death, it's definitely not winning. But in the scare factor right now, especially in the female childbearing age population, it is definitely ranking very high and it's very understandable.
Mm. So let's go through all that point by point. Start with where Zika, at least with this current crisis, where Zika has now been found. How many countries are we talking about?
Right now, we're talking about 52 countries that have reported Zika outbreaks since 2007. But we should also note that 5 out of those have already happened earlier and have concluded.
Let's talk about the evidence that Zika is causing some cases of microcephaly is not conclusive, but it is mounting. What do we know for sure right now about the link between the virus and birth defects?
What we do know is that we have increases of microcephaly throughout Brazil while we have a huge outbreak of Zika. So this we know. And we've seen Guillain-Barré syndrome rise in at least 7 countries now where we also see Zika outbreaks. So this is what we know. But we do not know whether these are definitely linked. We also have seen sexual transmission reported in a few cases, but we also don't know what the viral load is or if that is possible in any case or if this is something which every traveler has to be worried about. It doesn't look like it. So again, while we are collecting piece after piece of a big puzzle, we don't know the size of the puzzle.
So microcephaly, it's a condition where babies are born with abnormally small heads. Remind us what Guillain-Barré syndrome is.
Guillain-Barré syndrome is a neurological syndrome. It usually starts with some sort of tingling in the limbs and that sort of paralyzing. But if treated early, it has a very good chance of recovery and very few people have long-term effects with it.
There are studies, the first comparative studies, tracking pregnant women who were and were not infected by Zika. They're underway now in Brazil and Colombia. What will those studies tell us about Zika that we don't already know, and when will those results be out?
Well, these are just other pieces of the puzzle because we need to establish, of course, now, could it be Zika alone which causes this? Could it be Zika with some other infection? This would be very important to find out a certain percentage of a risk factor, how likely it is for a pregnant woman to contract anything like this if Zika is responsible. How likely is it that once bitten you actually have to worry, or can you travel? Is personal protection enough? Or do you need more? Should you completely avoid travel during pregnancy? What are the limiting factors? So the whole world basically is watching right now, which makes it such a scary scenario.
The virus seems to be moving rapidly across the Americas, at least South America anyway. As people get infected and gain immunity, are the number of cases of microcephaly and Guillain-Barré syndrome expected to decrease?
The normal development would be, as we know from other infectious diseases like dengue or chikungunya, that after a while, the population reaches an amount of normal immunity. We do not yet know how long this immunity would last, whether it's years or even longer. Therefore, we could expect the Zika virus infections to go in waves. And if the virus is responsible for microcephaly in Guillain-Barré, then, of course, we could expect infections also in a wave. But we don't know yet how long these waves would last. But hopefully, of course, research and development has caught up by then and may have given us enough protection to avoid further waves.
Christian Lindmeier, spokesman for the World Health Organization, joining us from Geneva. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
When I was in Tehran last month, Iranians wanted to know, if you talk to anyone from outside the U.S. lately, probably the first thing they ask you about is the U.S. presidential race. It's getting a lot of attention all over, including Israel. People there even know the primary lingo.
I was on the bus the other day, And a bunch of people were pushing and shoving and trying to get on the bus before the bus left, and there was a lot of commotion. And the bus driver shouted, "It's like Super Tuesday in here."
Daniel Estrin there. He's got this next story about two Israeli university students rooting for two very different American candidates.
Let's start with the Bernie supporter, Asaf Yusufov, a 24-year-old political science student. He heard about Sanders on an evening news show and went on YouTube and watched Sanders' videos for hours.
When I saw Bernie, I saw a political address that I can relate to. And this is something that it's really hard for me to find in Israel.
Asaf can't actually vote for Sanders. He's not American, though you wouldn't know that by looking at his record collection. He's a big fan of R.E.M., Cyndi Lauper, Neil Young. He says Israelis are deeply influenced by U.S. culture.
The picture we see is the American dream and the American way of life, you know, the luxury way of life. And as you read more, you talk to people, you see that's not the reality in the United States. And in Israel, Israel got enormous problems, I think, really similar to the United States.
Asaf is worried about big business in Israel, about a free market economy that ignores people's social needs. He thinks Bernie Sanders addresses those issues in a way no politician in Israel does. So he started a Facebook page called Bernie in Hebrew. He adds Hebrew subtitles to Bernie Sanders videos on YouTube and posts them on his Facebook page. One Israeli who's argued with Asaf on that page is a 25-year-old economics student named Nimrod Zuta. He likes Trump.
Israelis have this image of being, you know, very straightforward and very down to business. You know, we don't like this going in all directions. We just love to say as it is, you know. We have this, the chutzpah, you know. And I think Trump is very much like that. I think that if he was in the Israeli politics, he would probably succeed very much.
Nimrod started his own Facebook page, Trump Blue and White, Israel's national colors. He's posted a few articles about Trump's daughter Ivanka, who converted to Judaism, about Trump calling himself Israel's best friend. It's got about 300 likes, not yet as popular as the Bernie in Hebrew page, with about 3,000 likes. He says he wants Israelis to know who Trump really is and not the way he's portrayed in the local media. I asked Nimrod about Trump's comment that the U.S. should prevent Muslims from entering the U.S. until leaders can, quote, figure out what is going on.
This is a population that is not entirely on the side of the enemy, but, you know, they identify with it to some extent or another. They were born there. So obviously, if there is a war between the states and radical Islam, we need to check these guys out, you know.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu rejected Trump's remarks on Muslims. And among many Israelis, there's suspicion about Trump and Sanders, according to Eitan Gilboa. He's an Israeli expert on U.S. affairs, and he says Israelis are completely confused by this presidential election.
They don't understand how candidates such as Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders could even win one single primaries. Trump is perceived here as an arrogant person who cannot be trusted, who does not have a commitment to any particular position.
As for Bernie Sanders, Gilboa says, many Israelis find two main problems with him. First, they think he's trying to conceal his Jewish heritage.
The second thing is about his attitudes and relations to Israel. He is not saying anything about Israel.
Israelis don't hear him voicing strong support for their country the way the Republican candidates do. There's one other funny thing about Bernie Sanders and Israel. Some local newscasters have called him Barney. The two names are spelled the same way in Hebrew. When you go to Google and type in Hebrew the words Bernie in Hebrew, the first hits you get are episodes dubbed into Hebrew of the American children's show featuring Barney the Purple Dinosaur. For The World, Daniel Estrin, Tel Aviv.
Man versus Microchip, that's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. First Mali, then Burkina Faso, and now Ivory Coast. One by one, these countries in West Africa have been brutally visited by extremists in the past year who've stormed onto hotel property and killed people. The latest attack happened yesterday at a well-known beach resort outside Abidjan in Ivory Coast called Grand Bassam. At least 18 people died, and Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, or AQIM, has apparently claimed responsibility. Dion Searcy is West Africa Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Dion, tell us what happened in Ivory Coast yesterday. What do we know?
What we know so far is that the government there says that six gunmen stormed onto the beaches and started shooting. It was just a scene of mass carnage. I mean, this was the first sunny Sunday in weeks. It was a beautiful day. People were having Sunday brunch by the pool, swimming in the beach, and it just turned into mass carnage.
Has Ivory Coast had any problems with Islamic militancy in the past?
Not similar to this. I mean, Ivory Coast has had a lot of violence. There was civil war and violence surrounding an election a few years back when the president refused to step down. But this is a little bit new for them.
Tell me just a little bit more about Grand Bassam. What does it look like and who are the type of people who go there?
Sure. Grand Bassam is a World Heritage Site. A lot of old colonial architecture there. It used to be, at one time, a long time ago, was the French colonial capital there. The kinds of people who go there are expats, tourists, and a lot of elite Ivorians. There also is a good population of locals who hang out on the beach there. I mean, it's really the major getaway. If you're in Abidjan, it's going to be your beach getaway. It's only about an hour's drive from the city. It's just a really relaxing, beautiful palm tree lined coastline.
So with other recent attacks in Burkina Faso and Mali, how worried are authorities that when AQIM says it's going to launch surprise attacks all over West Africa, they seem to mean it?
Well, I think they're pretty worried. I mean, it looks like everyone is taking security very seriously. The next place that people think could be hit is Senegal. I live in Dakar right now, with the capital of Senegal, and there are checkpoints all over. Security, I was just at a coffee house, a little tiny coffee house, where there was a metal detector, one of those little wands that they wave over you. You can't go into a hotel without
That's new?
That's new, for sure. Security at the mall, you can't go into a hotel without popping your trunk and opening your glove box. I mean, all these things started really being put into place slowly after Bamako, after the attacks in Bamako, and then after Ouagadougou was hit. That was a huge, huge change. I mean, there are security officers along the coastal highway here every several hundred feet.
Wow. I'm just curious, what have you heard about the mood in Abidjan right now, considering they're just emerging from a civil war? And what is the mood right now in Dakar, several hundred miles away?
Well, I think in Abidjan, everyone is a little bit freaked out. I know that in Grand Bassam, it's just overrun right now with military officers and police authorities. And elsewhere throughout the region, everyone is really, really worried. I mean, there is just an absolute mood of tension, and it seems like every time this happens, you start worrying about everything, your kids, where you're going, what you're doing. For locals and expats alike, I think that it's absolutely the same. I mean, a lot of these attacks, in the past have been at big marketplaces, others at restaurants that people go out in a lot. So I think the mood is really, really tense, no matter where you are in the region and honestly in the world. I mean, look at the attacks in Paris, in California. I mean,
Ankara.
Right, exactly, in Ankara. Like, it's starting to feel that nowhere is safe, and I guess that's the point behind the attacks.
Dion Searcy with The New York Times, speaking with me from Dakar in Senegal. Good to hear from you. Thank you for your time.
Thanks so much.
Finally today, it's computer versus human in what's being called the Google Deep Mind Challenge. It's happening in Seoul, South Korea, and it's not going so well for the human. Tom Chivers is a science writer for BuzzFeed. What are they actually playing here?
Well, I mean, it's the game of Go, which I don't know how much you know about it, but it's this very ancient, sort of as old as chess game, played out on a board 19 by 19 squares, and you just put down a little stones, white or black stones, depending on which team you're playing, and you try and capture your opponent's stones. It's a very beautiful game to look at, but it's an incredibly complicated and difficult to learn game, which is why this is such a breakthrough for artificial intelligence research.
My understanding of Go is that is the original version of the board game Othello, which claims it takes a minute to learn and a lifetime to master.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It is, the rules are very simple to understand, but because there are so many ways that you can play each move, it's incredibly complex. I mean, the statistic that's often given is that there are more possible moves in a game of chess than there are atoms in the universe, but there are trillions and trillions more possible moves in Go. It is a huge factor more complicated than chess. Just the sheer mathematical space of things you can do in the game is enormous, and that's why you can't write a computer program that can just try everything out and work out the best way. It has to think a bit more like a human to work out the way through it.
So I know you've been following the challenge between AlphaGo and Lee Sedol, but what about in Seoul? I mean, are there spectators watching what's going on between Sedol and this computer?
There certainly are. I mean, there's...
Where?
They're sitting around in a sort of auditorium, not unlike watching... Well, I once went to watch a match of chess boxing, which is a thing I won't probably right. explain now, but you just see there's an audience sitting around, but there's also a press room, and I gather that they burst out in spontaneous and wild applause when Lee Sedol took the fourth game of the series and thus avoided a clean sweep for the robot, for the machine.
Yeah, so AlphaGo 3, Lee Sedol 1 in terms of matches. What does that actually mean, Lee Sedol winning the fourth match? Is that extraordinary?
AlphaGo wiped the floor with him certainly took the first three games, and everyone was just so surprised with it. So while yes, it is a big deal that the best human player in the world took the fourth game back, the real big news here is that the Go has been basically beaten by a computer now, and the computer will only get better. The way it works is it plays itself and learns from its own mistakes and will get better and better over the next million times it plays itself. This fourth game may be the last game that a human wins against the best Go computer in the world.
Yeah, so for that game four, though, I mean, I don't know how to ask this next question other than what went wrong with the computer?
Well, in the fourth game, Lee Sedol, as I understand it, made some really unusual moves which threw the computer, and it threw it into because it'd never seen anything like it, and then it threw it into some mistakes. So what happened in the fourth game was that Lee Sedol played an extraordinarily creative and brilliant game, and the computer wasn't able to keep up with it. But now it's got that creative idea into its data set. It can presumably, you know, work with that, and in future, that's one way you can't beat it again.
And then Game 5 is coming up?
Game 5 is coming up tomorrow. I mean, my own money, for what little it's worth, will be on AlphaGo. But, I mean, there's no telling. You know, it could go either way. Lee Sedol is clearly an extraordinary genius at this game. Who knows? Too close to call at this stage.
Tom Chivers, a science writer, joining us from the BuzzFeed newsroom in London. Thanks very much for your time, Tom.
Thank you.
And from the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.